Holly McNish has been writing poems about, as she puts it, anything and everything since she was 7 years old. Her work now reaches millions of us through her books, performances and short videos, making her one of the UK's most widely shared poets. In 2017, she won the Ted Hughes Award for her book Nobody Told Me, a collection of poetry and diary entries that she kept from the moment she discovered she was pregnant until her daughter was three. She's published six other collections, including her most recent, Virgin, which explores how one six-letter word holds such power. Well, we got music by Telemann, Joseph Boulogne, Chevalier de Saint-Georges and Nina Simone, Holly, but we're going to begin, I think, with Tchaikovsky. What made you home in on this?
This is one of the first pieces of classical music I heard, but it also makes me giggle quite a lot. My mum took me to see the ballet with two of my friends, and she was quite nervous about it, and we were very excited about it. My mum was really panicking because she didn't think we looked quite posh enough to go, and we bumped into a mother and her daughter who were wearing Laura Ashley dresses. I remember that really vividly. And my mum was like, oh no, we should have had that sort of clothing on. So it was that kind of idea of feeling that you don't belong somewhere. But then by the end, I felt more like I did, like it's for everyone. And my mum got the giggles, and we did get shushed by a woman in front of us who wasn't appreciating our laughter, which is fair enough. But this reminds me of a lot of those moments with my mum, and also trying to do ballet as a kid and being told that I jumped like an elephant by the teacher. So I didn't carry that on after the age of about eight.
But music, and especially a great tune, is a great sort of unifier, isn't it? And it doesn't really matter what the label is if it speaks to you.
No, that's true. I think that's what I've slowly realised going through a lot of the classical music that I do love. I used to play the recorder, so lots of songs that I played that I loved, and a lot of films that I've watched, and this, just because it's so lighthearted, it's such a lovely one to listen to.
Well, it's the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, isn't it?
Beautiful. Yeah. And I remember playing this one. Everything I've tried to play on the recorder, sort of a joke in my family that I never swapped instrument. I just stuck with the recorder until I was about 25.
Well, here it is with the London Symphony Orchestra rather than the recorder.
Yeah. Do you know, listening to that again, it has the same effect on me that a lot of books that I read as a kid do. It makes me think of this little music box that I had that my gran gave to me and this wee ballerina that danced in it. And I think I heard this for the first time around the same time that I read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And I never looked at wardrobes in the same way. It's magical, it's fantastical. It's all the things you need on a day when it's pouring with rain and you've got a lot of washing, a lot of washing to do to put something like that on and just blast it loudly in your house.
Yeah. We heard The Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from The Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andre Previn. Holly McNish, you did mention a recorder just now. So did you take up the recorder when you were young?
Yeah, I've honestly no idea why I loved it so much. No one in my family pushed me to play the recorder. And my mum and dad, they don't read music, they don't play instruments. They love music, and we had a lot of music in the house. But I played it at primary school like everyone did. We all learned the recorder. And then I just carried on. And I don't know why. I feel like a lot of it is to do with there are these Osborne first recorder books, and I absolutely love them, and they're full of little cartoons, and they teach you about each bit of music that you play, fingering charts, but they're these little jelly bean looking creatures that, you know, have all these, and I loved reading those books. I'm not sure my family was that enamored by it. They're very supportive, but my dad, I had to practice the recorder in sort of dining room, which meant that two doors could be closed between me and the lounge where everyone watched the television. Otherwise, it was a bit loud to hear Family Fortunes.
So was there encouragement then, or was there not?
There was a lot of encouragement from both of them. My mum in particular, she would sit and listen to me and go through these books with me. There was quite a lot of joking about whether I was going to move on. And I played the oboe for a while. You could pick up and choose another instrument at secondary school for free.
That's much more difficult than the recorder.
I think I'd done up to grade five on the recorder by then, so a lot of the fingering was quite easy to pick up. I tried the flute, but I used to pass out, and I still to this day don't understand how anybody can play the flute. I just used to get so lightheaded. And I did actually purchase, there was a great scheme. I sort of paid monthly installments to buy a saxophone, and I really wanted to learn the saxophone because my gran loved a lot of jazz music. And then I got pregnant, I'd say about a week after I'd finally paid off and got this beautiful black saxophone with gold buttons, and I still have not learnt to play it, but it's still in my house. I think when my daughter's 18, then I'll have more time.
Future project.
Future project, yeah.
The next piece is indeed a recorder piece, perhaps one you played.
Yeah. So this one I chose because it's the first that I learnt to play on the recorder after you were, you know, doing Buzzy B, which was just B constantly. After you'd got through that stage of it sounding quite terrible for a couple of years, I remember being able to play this and just thinking that it was so amazing that there was this piece of music written hundreds of years ago for a same instrument that I could just pick up and read. And I only just discovered the lyrics of it about 6 months ago, which I was quite shocked by the lyrics. Just this constant complaint about the woman Greensleeves not giving her love to the man, even though he's got people to give her supper and got people to buy her things. And I thought, oh gosh, it's quite similar, the lyrics, to quite a lot of love songs nowadays that I don't really like. But I've pushed them aside so that I can still enjoy the music.
Thank you. What did you think of that playing?
Knowing how long it took me to reach those sort of high notes on the recorder without it sounding absolutely awful, and to play that fast and to do that many trills. I was obsessed with trills. I used to just add them into every piece I was playing, even if they weren't in there, because I thought they sounded so fancy. And I remember for one of my exams, the music teacher telling me off because I was adding trills where they weren't written in. But listening to that, I thought, I wish actually I could go back and try probably about a third of the speed playing that so fast. I can't even imagine how much skill that takes.
Well, we heard Greensleeves to a Ground, performed by Mikola Petri, the recorder virtuoso, David Petri playing the cello, and Hannah Petri on the harpsichord. Holly McNeish, did you have a favourite poem as a child?
My favourite poem was Please, Mrs. Butler by Allan Ohlberg. I really liked to laugh. And then there was another poem called Scissors, which maybe that sort of rivals as my favourite poem. But it was like, nobody leave the room, everyone listen to me. We had 10 pairs of scissors and now there's only three. And this teacher getting more and more angry, just not allowing these children to go home until they find these scissors. I absolutely loved that. And then when I was a bit older, I think the first poem that wasn't a children's poem that I loved was Dulce in Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen. Had no idea what the title meant because I didn't study Latin, but my gran showed me the poem, read it to me, started crying. She was talking about all the men in her family that had lost their lives in the First World War. And I think that was the first time I saw a political poem or a poem that could really make a difference, affect people in that way.
It's extraordinary how Owen does actually communicate with people of all ages.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think because part of us always imagine what must it be like to suffer in the way those soldiers did.
Horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And I think nowadays this sort of idea that if a book isn't about your life or you can't relate to it, that necessarily you might not enjoy it or you might not read it. Such a strange idea, because so much of the literature that I've read and so much of the poetry, I specifically read it in order to understand somebody else's experience, and that's what I want. I don't want to read books that are just about my own life.
Do you remember the first poems that you wrote?
I do. It's too rude to read on the radio, but I wrote it when I was 9 because my parents wouldn't let me get a cat. Yeah, I remember the first one that I felt really sort of tingly about writing was a poem called Love when I was about 10. It's like love is, love is, love is, and all these different things that I thought love is, and I thought it was so mature. And I remember a line, love is the old man selling the beer, and I've no idea what was going through my head. I remember feeling like, yeah, I need to keep this to myself and hide it.
Interesting that you kept a diary in the form of poetry until you were about 12.
Yeah, that's still how I keep my diary. I've got hundreds of poems that I would never share with anyone. I honestly don't know why, I just absolutely loved it. I used to sit in my bedroom writing poems. I remember my mum saying to me, don't write anything in your diary that you wouldn't want someone to read, which is quite funny because my whole career has sort of been built on now publishing some of these diaries. But I think the idea that it was like a bit more surreal and maybe someone would be less interested in reading it if they found it, because no one around me I knew would really want to read poems that I'd written, and also maybe wouldn't quite catch everything that I was saying if they did.
Your parents were both Scottish?
Yeah, they're both from Glasgow. My gran lived at number sort of 1,890 on the Ring Road around Glasgow.
You often reference your grandmother in your poems, such as Things My Grandma Warned Me to Conceal.
Yeah.
She sounded quite wise.
Yeah, I think she really was. She also really wanted to keep learning. And we had a lot of conversations about things that I guess we disagreed on, or things that she'd been brought up very differently to the way that I had. We talked a lot about things that I wouldn't expect to have spoken to her about, like when I was pregnant and I wasn't married. She was kind of angry about it, kind of sad, worried, and we spoke through what that would have been like for her if she'd also been pregnant and unmarried. I remember her saying how she started working and a lot of people wouldn't speak to her because she'd got a job and it was embarrassing for my granddad, even though he was all for it. And then her own salary, she couldn't get out of the bank without his signature. And she was basically really overwhelmingly happy that things had changed for her grandchildren, I think.
Your maternal grandmother passed away during lockdown and you couldn't attend the funeral, had to watch it online. But you wrote a very touching poem about this called chasing ceremony, memorialising her with beautiful details about her hair curlers, watching countdown, exactly how she liked her tea, just a splash of milk.
Yeah, always.
Did that all help with the grief, in a sense?
Yeah, it really, really helped. I think that's one thing that poetry's done for me all my life. I think it's made me less of an angry person. I think it's made me calmer, but I think it's been a sort of support all my life. And I mean, I watched that on my own. I just wrote and wrote and wrote all night, really.
When you say less of an angry person, were you an angry person?
I think everyone should be angry, really. I'm angry all the time. I mean, there's so much to be angry about, but I feel like if I hadn't had some sort of outlet for it to not calm me down. I don't want to be calmed down. I don't really think anybody should be very calm until everything is fairer. But I guess doing something more practical, or really, really sorting out how you feel about something or what could help, I think instead of just being angry, but that doing no good.
I think this next track reminds you of your grandparents.
Yeah, it really reminds me of them. And I was listening to it this morning while walking through London and then started crying, so I stopped. It reminds me of my maternal granddad the most. I don't know if other people had this, but both my grandparents had this really nice lounge, but we were never allowed in it. It had to be saved perfect. You know, some of it still had like labels on, just in case. My gran used to say, just in case the Queen turns up, it needs to be perfect. And then we'd all sit in this much smaller room, you know, next to the kitchen. But when my granddad wanted to play this music, the record player was in the other room. And it was just that feeling of being allowed into that comfier sofa room, listening to this on a record and just seeing my grandparents dancing.
L is for the way you look at me. O is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love, is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two in love can make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you. Is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love. Is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two in love can make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you. Love was made for me and you.
I bet the young poet in you enjoyed very, very extraordinary.
Oh, it's so difficult listening to that song without crying. It's really just... Some people think that a lot of the women in my family had our kids sort of too early. Like, I think every single one of my grandmas and me, there was a slight frowning. I mean, I was 26. I wasn't that young, but you know, 26, I'm married. I just finished my master's. But I'm so glad because when my daughter was born, she had four great-grandmas, knew them all really well, still has two great-grandmas, and it's just this amazing thing. So I went on so many trips with my mum, my gran, my daughter and me, and that song, she never met my granddad, who was just obsessed with Nat King Cole, but she belts this song out when we're in the car. And the fact that I've now got this sort of nearly 16-year-old that is screaming and loving this music, I just can see and hear my granddad in her, and it brings all of these sides of my family together. And I, yeah, absolutely love it. But I also bawl my eyes out most of the time.
Love, L-O-V-E, composed by Bert Comfort, with lyrics by Milt Gabler and performed, of course, by Nat King Cole. Holly McNish, you've written about the awkwardness of being a teenager. Yeah. In your collection, Plum, you even shared some of your teenage poems. That was quite brave. Is it difficult to decide what you're going to reveal?
It's really difficult to decide. And I had a really scathing review of that book, actually. Somebody really thought the poems were just terrible. But one of the suggestions was how arrogant it was to put these young poems as if I thought that they were, you know, good enough publication. But actually, I just thought it'd be quite funny. I put some really awful love poems. And also as a way to encourage young people that I do work with not to throw these things out, or not to just think, oh, this is rubbish, you know, because it's been so funny. But then choosing what to share. I think I've become more and more open about sharing certain things, but there is still a lot that I don't share. If there was something written about somebody else and it was their life, and I probably would hold back.
Honesty is a trademark of your poetry. It's a direct form of communication.
Yeah.
And sharing thoughts that people might feel are embarrassing or taboo in your writing.
Yeah, I also think the more that I've shared, the more I've had feedback from people saying thank you. I guess people that maybe aren't as confident or don't write poetry, or have, like my family, aren't enamoured by some of the poems that I share, but they're really supportive. They're not going to disown me for writing about something that they think is taboo or vulgar, as I've been called, or too sexual or whatever it is. So I think I've got a lot of freedom that some people don't have. And if it makes anyone or any child or teenager or adult feel less ashamed and more likely to ask for help or more likely to feel seen, then I've got over this idea of being embarrassed by certain topics if I think it will be helpful to share it.
After school, you went to Cambridge to study modern and medieval languages.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy university life?
Yes and no. I feel like to say no, it was such a privilege to go there, and I'm really excited that I went and got in. But it opened my eyes a lot. Like, I had some funny situations. Like, there was a group of girls that had all gone to sort of private schools, and I remember we had to write down our address. One of them saw that I had a house number, and she got really excited and said that she'd never met anyone with a house number before, and they all kind of got excited. So there were things like that, which actually now I think I would just find funny, but at 18 I just found extremely annoying. And it made me feel a bit odd. I think in general I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed what I was learning.
And you spent a year in Guadeloupe, didn't you, in the Caribbean, teaching English and learning Guadeloupe Creole.
Yes, that was amazing. I enjoyed that a lot because the language was beautiful. And I went to classes with my friends to try and study it.
And this experience led to your next piece.
Yes, because I found out about this composer, Joseph Bolon Chevalier de Saint-Georges. Nice long name. People I met there referred to Mozart as the White Chevalier. There was this trend to refer to him as the Black Mozart, and I found that quite insulting. So I sort of flipped that on its back. And I just listened to the music, thought it was incredible. And the history of this boy, then man, was sort of fascinating. And now I'm realising quite common that so much genius and so much talent has been hidden, censored. And I just feel really grateful when I listen to his music, and I listen to it a lot. I guess it sort of bolsters me a little bit to also keep fighting for that and realise how grateful I am that someone somewhere made the effort to uncover all of his amazing work.
Thank you.
The Allegro of the Symphonie Concertante in G major, composed by Joseph Boulogne Chevalier de Saint-Georges, performed by Miriam Fried and Jamie Laredo with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Paul Freeman. Holly, when did you finally pluck up the courage to perform your poetry publicly?
I think the first time I ever read a poem to anyone other than my mum, I was about 23, and I went to the Poetry Cafe in Covent Garden. Actually, the first time I went there, I was too nervous to even go in. I'd never been to anything like that before. And there's the cafe upstairs, but then the poetry's downstairs. And because of that, I couldn't see, so I left. And then the second time, I was too worried about going downstairs and didn't quite know where I'd sit, and I was on my own. So then the third time, my brother came with me, and I read a poem about beauty magazines, I think it was. And it was really lovely, and the people there were lovely, and I realised it wasn't going to harm anyone, me reading, and it wasn't going to kill me to read it.
What would you say to people who suggest that spoken word writing can't be as subtle as poems written for the page, or that it favours authenticity over nuance?
I just sort of ignore those people. I feel like I've had too much of it. There's always, every year, something about this sort of rivalry between spoken poetry and poetry on a page. But I think most people that are actually involved in poetry and write it or read it, I don't think they're arguing in the same way as the sort of journalists are making out. And I feel like there's a line. And some people, like very much only spoken, people who are writing poems for a stage, they'll maybe do audience participation, or it's like a real stage show. And then there are people, they just write for the page, and it's maybe shape poems, things that don't really work in a spoken form. But I think most people are somewhere in the middle.
There's room for both.
There's room for both. I think the division isn't quite as big as it's...
You released an album of poetry and music in 2014 called Versus.
Yeah.
Making you the first poet to record at Abbey Road Studios, actually.
Yeah.
That must have been fun.
It was amazing. And it was all thanks to a man called Kwame Kwatan, who's normally a music manager. And I worked with him for about a year. It was...
You went on to collaborate with Jules Buckley and the Metropole Orchestra, jazz orchestra based in the Netherlands. Did adding music change the poems for you at all?
Yes, it did change it. I think as someone who's not that comfortable on stage, I am now, but I guess wasn't so much at the time, it was the most frightening thing in that way that I've ever done. And when I got on stage, I think I was so nervous. The whole experience of it, it wasn't lost on me, but it was very intimidating. But listening back to it, I think it just made me feel a lot grander than I'd ever felt as a poet. Like, it's such a quiet art form, and I'm normally sitting on my own writing poems or standing totally alone on stage, which is also terrifying. I think the main thing it made me realise is just how talented people that play instruments are, and composers.
We're going to hear a track called Wow.
Yeah.
Just introduce this for us.
So Wow is one of my favourite poems to read. It's a poem that I wrote when my daughter was about one, and it was the first time she'd seen herself nude in front of a mirror. And I, at that time, hadn't looked at myself in a mirror since I gave birth, because I had just been made to feel, not by anyone around me, but by society, like my body was now awful after giving birth. And I remember seeing her walking up to this mirror, she looked at herself as if she was some sort of goddess, like amazed by this reflection, how cool it was, and started laughing and then applauding. And I remember looking at this one-year-old and being so angry that I'd been made to feel like my body was now worse after doing this amazing thing, but also thinking that one-year-old is smarter than I am at 27, and I really need to take a little bit of that and applaud my naked butt in the mirror as well. So this poem is about that moment. My body is amazing. I can almost hear her saying it as she stands naked at the mirror, hands clapping in applause to it. She's naked, bold and proud, her mouth open wide and round like, wow, my body is amazing. She's 1 year old and loving it. Big belly sticking out. Thighs like mini tyre towels. And when she looks at her reflection, she always shouts aloud like, wow, this body is so great. Gazing down now, I try to do the same. Ignore the plastic advert spreads that pass me on the way. I say my body is amazing, despite what some might say. I say my body is amazing, despite the claims you make. The nip and tuck and cuts and sucks that fill my walk to work each day. Enhancement ads and happiness will only come with curves this way. And if I lay in front of you today, clothes drop to the floor. You prescribe me what I could have less of and what I should want more of. A tick box. What could be chopped off? Your red pen ready, hand aside. Your eyes deciding what to slice from lips to cheek to bum to thighs. The lines below my eyes, you say. I ought to peel or pull away. My breasts will start to sag one day. That breastfed baby there to blame. She came into the world, you say that's great. But now behold your face. Your saggy stomach, baggy eyes, stretch mark skin. You look and sigh. My eyes tighten. My legs inject, my thighs cut back, my head perfect, my stomach flattened, my breasts enhanced. Don't smile too much, oh God, don't laugh. As you mark me, like a canvas page in circled bouts of red, I feel the need to tell you, you might praise my skin instead. Cos as you chat about correction, you're plucking cuts and lasers, briefcase stuffed with time relapses, scalp or leather razors, I take up your red pen to my cheek and mark two stripes on either side. A naked, painted warrior could be a sorer sight for eyes, cos I am ready for your battles now. My body's felt the worst. No scalp or cut intenses that last damn push of birth, and I have seen with awed amazement what our body brave can do, and now I'm marked like tribal tattoos with the tales my flesh went through. But those lines that mark my saggy stomach mark me like gold, and the folds below my eyes tell a tale just as bold. My laughter lines are getting deeper now because I smile twice as much, so if you palm read these first wrinkles, my life would light up. The official position is that smooth skin is queen, but without any lines, there's no reading between them. A storybook opening, my life has just begun, and once upon never plays if I cling to line one as you try to cover the living I've done. As a human, a woman, and now as a mum. But your red pen can't rub out the nights I've not slept, the laughter I wept or the parts that I bled. The baby I held in my stomach that stretched, the breast that got heavy cause baby was fed. The parties I've had out, the sleep I've missed out on, the dinners I've shoved down my throat like a python. As you pile on the pressure to cover my life, I wonder what on earth is so wrong with your sight. If my mind and my memory can tell you my tales, then why can my body not tell them as well? As our babies stand naked, applauding their skin, I can't wait for their lives and their lines to begin.
Wow! That's great fun. Did you enjoy it once it got going?
Do you know what? I feel terrible saying no here, but I was honestly terrified.
Wow, by Holly McNish, with music composed and conducted by Jules Buckley and performed by the Metropole Orchestra. Holly, the birth of your daughter in 2010 sparked more creativity in poems about motherhood. You brought out a whole collection called Nobody Told Me.
I think there was just so much to write about. Like, I don't really understand this idea that having a child would make you less creative.
It could make you more creative.
I mean, literally, a growing a life inside your body, like, it's a bit of an overwhelming experience. And there was just so much that I wanted to write about, so much I didn't understand, so many feelings I was having that I felt kind of guilty about, worry, terror, love, confusion. And I think the idea that you wouldn't get any poetry out of that, I think, is ridiculous.
One of the poems in that collection, which made a huge impact, was Embarrassed. It attracted millions of views online. And for those who don't know it, perhaps you could explain what provoked you to write it.
Yeah, so Embarrassed was a poem about feeling embarrassed to breastfeed my daughter in public. I was sitting in a cafe and I didn't have many comments from people at all. Mostly it was really supportive or just, you know, neutral. But one person said something to me about, should you be doing this here, when I was feeding her? And it just totally threw me and I felt so embarrassed. So I left the cafe and I took my daughter off the breast. She obviously started screaming like anyone would if you just suddenly took a plate of food away from them. And I remember walking through town, sort of desperately trying to find somewhere to feed her, and went to the public toilets near the shopping centre in Cambridge, sat on the toilet, fed her, and she fell asleep. And I just remember thinking, how do I live in a world that in any way makes me feel awkward about this? And I sat in that toilet for the whole 40 minutes that my daughter slept, just listening to people going to the toilet, thinking I could have been in a cafe, I could have ordered a tea, I could have been reading my book. And I wrote the poem on my phone, basically about just about that, about being embarrassed, didn't share it. And it was my daughter's dad actually that said, I think you should record that one.
Music from a film composer next.
Yes. I think I could have chosen any track from this film. The soundtrack is so beautiful, and it's from a film called Cinema Paradiso, which is a story of a cinema which is being left in ruin. It's going to be closed down, and it's all about the young boy and a man that works in the cinema. It's just a kind of beautiful, beautiful love story to that relationship, but also a beautiful story about this venue. I like to play it when I'm on tour, and I feel like it's such an honour that I now have this map of the UK and Europe, but the UK mainly, of all these amazing arts venues and theatres. And this slightly reminds me, there's this one place, the Magic Lantern in Tawyn, in the middle of this seaside town, this bright pink old, was a cinema and is now this arts venue and theatre. Everyone there just said it's the most amazing place to have in this town, and they all go to everything that's on, and they have loads of bands playing, and they have wee plates of food and the big heavy velvet red curtains. And it's such an amazing world to be a part of. So that's what I think when I listen to this piece of music.
It's quite a yearning piece in a way, isn't it?
I love it. I feel like it's so sad and so hopeful. And I don't know if that's the music or because I'm thinking of the film, but it really makes me think how many beautiful, brilliant people there are in the world. And just this idea of this little beautiful boy growing up and just wanting to save this place that's given him so much magic in his life. It makes me just think, oh, there's so much beauty and so much gorgeousness in people that we could just nurture.
Childhood and Manhood from the film Cinema Paradiso, composed and conducted by Ennio Morricone. Something else that excites you, Holly, is numbers. Maths is one of your subjects and you've excelled in it.
Yeah, I love maths. I miss maths. I did it up until A-level and then I did development economics as a master's. And I still have weird dreams because I guess I did A-levels of French, German, English, literature and maths and then went on to university and kind of dropped the maths but kept up the languages and the literature. And sometimes I have dreams, still panicked that I've forgotten to revise for maths, but I kind of miss it. I miss the clarity.
You wrote a poem called Mathematics.
I did, yeah, about the fallacy of labour theory that I was studying. I've really been obsessed with writing poems and I used to write them at school a lot and in university. I used to write quite a lot of my lecture notes in poems. So that was originally a lecture note and it was a lecture on forced migration and migration, the effects of immigration and this false idea that for like one person coming into a country, that means that one job is going to be removed from somebody that's already in the country and how it's such an easy story to tell people, but it's absolutely mathematically and economically false because a lot of people come in and they will set up more jobs for people or that, you know, there's all sorts of things that happen in an economy. And it's kind of easy to think, yeah, that makes sense. But actually, it's mathematically incorrect. So the poem was about that.
What's next? I think it's Nina Simone.
I love a lot of Nina Simone songs and could have chosen any of them. But I think this one, Feeling Good, is a very positive song. It's just got one of the best first lines. And I've never heard a song sung to nature so much. I just think it's incredible. And I remember saying to my daughter, you know, not that this is always going to work, but any song where somebody mentions their mother or nature are normally going to be pretty good. It just reminds me how beautiful things like fireflies are. And the one line in it that I find really touching is the idea of having peaceful sleep at the end of the day, how that really is the marker of, I think, what most people want. It's gorgeous.
Well, feel free to sing along.
Thanks.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Yeah, yeah. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine. It's a new day, it's a new life for me.
listening to her singing a song like that, knowing the hope that she gave people through her music, the fights that she had to go through just to have basic rights, just to sing, just to live. It's just incredible.
It's quite a raunchy backing, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. Yeah, it is. To be honest, I've never thought about that. But now you say it, yeah, it is. Maybe why it's even better to dance to.
Feeling Good, performed by Nina Simone and written by Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus. Alongside your poetry, Holly McNish, you often write in prose, but in 2021 you decided to create a modern retelling of Sophocles' classic play Antigone. What was it about that story that drew you to it?
So I was asked to. That is why. I'm not going to pretend that I knew a lot about sort of ancient Greek tragedy. I didn't, and I had never read anything. I'd not studied any at school. And there's this brilliant place called Story House up in Chester. It's a library, a cinema, a theatre in one. And the whole place is designed so that people that are from all different social classes or different backgrounds will not be intimidated by certain spaces. And they approached me and said, we want to do a retelling of Antigone written in modern language for their youth theatre. And I said, no. I said, no chance. I don't know anything about playwriting. I've not read any tragedies. So they kept asking it and they said, it's because you don't know about that, but we like your writing in general.
And it does speak to a contemporary audience, Greek theatre.
Yeah, I think there's so many similarities. I think there's a thing that I think it must happen with classical music as well as poetry. And I think it happens with theatre, and it doesn't happen with certain other art forms, is that somebody will read one poem, think I don't understand that, I don't like it, and therefore just blanket say no to poetry. And I think I've done that with I've listened to a classical music track, oh, I don't really recognise it, I don't really understand it. And I've said, oh, I don't think I like classical music. But I've never heard anyone do that with watching a film. You don't enjoy the film and then you say, I don't like films. We don't really do it with other music. Maybe it's like a class thing or, you know, I'm not sure what it is. There was so much in the original script of Antigone, which it sounded like direct quotes from Trump. There were some lines from this King Creon that were really what I just heard Trump say on the news, or things that I'd just seen in EastEnders. It was so similar to a modern day soap opera. So I thought, actually, I think when something's very, very old, we sometimes think it's very, very privileged or very exclusive, but it's just old.
We're going to return to the recorder again.
Oh, lovely. So this, I practiced this thousands of times, I'd say. I'm pretty sure it was my grade 5 recorder exam. I've actually never heard how it should sound. I've only heard me play it. And I wanted to hear it, but I also, I guess I wanted to be reminded of that just hard graft that I did learning this. And I still don't really understand why I wanted to keep playing the recorder. I think it was something to do with the fact that it was one of those instruments that had been around for so long. And maybe the fact that people make fun of it so much. And I still go back and play it, I'd say about once a month. But I'm quite sad that I can only play it about half the pace now. But I still love it. And I sometimes play it to my mum as a joke and she's like, oh, remember like how much practice you had to do for that. And I just wanted to hear it on this programme. I wanted to hear what it was meant to sound like.
Well, here you are. Thank you.
was amazing. I didn't play it that fast. And it really brought back a memory that for that exam, I got bought a wooden recorder, not a plastic one. And I remember saying to my friends, it cost £100. Let's stop making fun of the recorder. And they were like, are you seriously still playing the recorder? And I was like, look at this. It was £100. This recorder was £100. And it's still the one that I've got. Obviously, I look after it like very meticulously. But I just remember having this thing bought for me that was so expensive. I just love it. That was amazing hearing it.
It does have the recorder, the qualities of the human voice in some ways, doesn't it? It's so breathy.
Yeah, that's true. I think so many people, when they think of the recorder, they think of the descant. It's obviously the one that you start on because little kids' hands couldn't possibly play the other recorders.
But there's bass and alto, there's all sorts of
things. Yeah, I remember like moving on to, I think it was the bass that was taller than me when I tried it. I think trying to convince my friends as a teenager, you know, there's different ones, look at this. But they just sort of found it funny.
The Sonata in C Major for recorder by Telemann, performed by Dan Lauren, recorder, Anna Paradiso, harpsichord, and Mats Olofsson, the cello. Holly McNeish, your latest collection, Virgin, is about that one little six-letter word and how much impact it can have. What made you think you wanted to explore this in its widest sense?
I guess because I've been writing books, like the last two books that I wrote called Slug and Lobster, and they're all about things that I've, in terms of society and culture, has sort of made me find disgusting or hate, things that I don't think I want to hate or be ashamed about, like my body or sex or grief, crying, all sorts of different things that I think we're made to feel really ashamed of, and that the world would be so much better if we weren't made to feel that way about certain things. And a lot of it, for me, is traced back to this idea of virginity, this idea that somebody is pure and then this one first act of either intercourse or abuse can literally change your state of being. And it fascinates me and terrifies me that we still, like of all the human experiences in life, sensually or otherwise, that this one act is the only thing that I've ever been told actually changes your being. And I think it's a really dangerous thing to keep pushing. Yeah.
Could you read us one of the poems, perhaps the one called In Loving Memory of the Kissing Tree?
Oh, yeah, I would love to. This is the first time I've ever read it to anyone, actually, I think. So it's quite nice to do it here. So this is just about my first kiss. It was really lovely. So it's sort of a thank you for it, but it was in the school woods when I was about 10. In loving memory of the kissing tree, the pale green leaves of the common hawthorn are often the first to appear each spring. And there we were, almost summer, almost 11, sunbrellaed by the low white blossom. It took 3 trips to the tree till I was certain. He smiled each time I shook my head, carved a compass heart in bark instead. For some, it is the May tree, nicknamed for the month it bloomed. For us, it was the kissing tree, love shrine to lips on lips in the woods inside our school. The second time, petal confetti blessings, lips ready, I turned my head. No, sorry, don't worry, he kissed me on the cheek instead. These blossoms were once banned, spring garlands made for May Day celebrations, judged unholy crowns to carnal love by those in power. How strange, the things we've had forbidden, such fear of flowers. It has been said that the hawthorn is an unlucky plant to bring into a house. Then again, so much has been said. The third time, yes, he checks again. Yes, yes, my mouth pressed against his mouth. A softness I still feel each time the hawthorn bloom is out. My lips are layered now with many years of grateful kissing, like paintings painted over paintings. About that first kiss, I don't remember much. How many seconds we pressed our lips together. But afterwards, he whispered, thank you. Thank you very much. And set the bar at 10 forever.
To which I can only say thank you very much.
No problem.
Folk music next.
I wanted to include this because this is the newest artist that I found. And I just fell in love with this song. I wanted to play this because it's a bit of an ode to that idea that I think a lot of people stop finding new music and tend to refer to the music they listen to in their teens and 20s as the music of their generation. And I remember my daughter saying to me, what was the music like in your day? And I was like, you know, I'm not dead. Like, these are still my days. Like, I'm still finding new music. And I find new music all the time. And I love to have such access to such new songs. And this is my current favourite of hers, called The Solitude.
The Solitude, performed by Bedouin from her 2021 album, Waysides.
I love the calmness of the music. I love her voice, but it's another song that I just love the words of. I co-parent, so I'm on my own a couple of days a week. This song for me and the words of it are just this perfect balance of how much you sometimes love being on your own, and lots of people really crave time alone. And then sometimes when you don't want to be and you just really miss someone. And I don't just think about it in terms of, like, my partner lives away, so whenever he goes, I sort of think about this song. But also with my daughter growing up, There's a line in the song about there's too many pillows in my bed. And I remember thinking that when my kid was little, she was like always in my bed, like always waking me up early. And now it's like, oh, my bed's too big. Someone come and like come and make it feel too claustrophobic again, you know, that sort of balance.
Holly, your daughter's now a teenager, and I wonder how much your perspective as a parent informed this recent collection. Actually, you have as much compassion and sympathy with boys and men negotiating the adult world as you do for girls.
Yeah, I think it must be terrifying. I've written a lot. I've written a recent poem I wrote, which is not in a book, but which is online. I kept seeing these headlines talking about how many boys love Andrew Tate and how many boys agree with him. And that was always the headline. I think the headlines are always negative about teenage boys. And actually, I think it was something like 1 in 6 boys have this positive view of Andrew Tate. And I thought, but that means that 5 in 6 don't. 5 in 6 either don't know who he is or they don't agree with what he says and they don't want to, you know. And it's not to ignore the problems, but I think if you constantly push this negative, then it doesn't inspire any of those 5 out of 6 to feel, you know, positive about the world or feel loved.
Well, in fact, the new collection also explores the joy of firsts in the broadest sense. And the idea that we're all virgins, really, still, in one sense, still discovering the things you've been talking about today, the music you've been talking.
I thought that because the first time I went to a poetry reading, the one that I was talking about, they said, oh, have you read your poetry before? And I said, no. And they said, oh, she's a poetry virgin. I'd never thought about it like that. And this woman shouted, you don't look like a virgin from the back. And it was all very funny. But I feel like there's a slight thing with certain adults. When I reached even about 30, I think, that people started saying there's no point to learn anymore. Or now, because we have all these names for, like, you know, baby, toddler, teen, adult, as if that's when everything stops. And I feel like I've just discovered so many new things, obviously, as you just keep doing all your life. So yeah, there's a poem I've written in it about all these things that I've not done. I've not seen an octopus. I've not eaten a peach from a peach tree, which is a big aim in life, just to eat a fresh peach off a peach tree. And they're not like huge things and not expensive things that I want to do, but just thinking about all the music I don't know.
Well, we've mentioned it's not only looking forward and what's happening now, but as you showed earlier with Joseph Boulogne, looking back too to vast areas of music probably unknown.
Absolutely. And how many new people are we going to discover from living hopefully in a society that gets less and less prejudiced?
Holly McNeish, you must be asked quite often by young poets for advice. And what do you tend to say to people?
I say read poetry. That's it. I don't really think there's any better way to get better at writing than reading. If I'm going to edit any of my poems, I always have 3 poetry books on my desk by poets that I think are either very different or more skilled at a certain form. And I always spend, I'd say, about 30 minutes before I would ever have a day of editing, reading other people's work.
One of the things that seems to me to have come out of everything you've said is the importance of curiosity.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I am curious about everything. And I just love discovering new sounds, new voices, new lyrics, new words.
What is your last piece?
So my last work is by a young singer, musician, rapper called Dave, and the piece is called Black. And the fact that he wrote this at 21 years old, I think, is extraordinary. He started writing lyrics at 11. He started playing the piano at 11. And I just think he's brilliant. And I guess I wanted to include this because it's relatively new. It's also a song that I've learnt through my daughter.
Well, Dave, he won the Album of the Year at the 2020 Brit Awards, also won the Mercury Prize in 2019. So yeah, Obviously something quite exciting about him.
Yeah, quite rightly. I just think he's so intelligent. I think he's brilliant, a brilliant musician. What I especially love about this version is that it's live and you can hear the audience, and if you go and watch it, you can see him playing the piano at the same time as doing this rap. It's a brilliant song to end on, and I think it's one of the most important ones that's been written recently.
Holly McNeish, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Look, Black is beautiful, black is excellent. Black is pain, black is joy, black is evident. Working twice as hard as the people you know you're better than, cause you need to do double what they do so you can level them. Black is so much deeper than just African-American. Our heritage been severed, you never got to experiment with family trees, cause they teach you about famine and greed. Show you pictures of our fam on their knees, tell us we used to be barbaric, we had actual queens. Black is watching child soldiers getting killed by other children, feeling sick so quick, this could have happened to me. Mummy watching, telling stories about your dad and your niece. Listen, the blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice. Kid dies, the blacker the killer, the sweeter the news. And if he's white, you give him a chance, he's ill and confused. If he's black, he's probably armed, you see him and shoot. Look, black is growing up around a barbershop. Mummy saying stay away from trouble, you're in yard a lot. Studying for ages, appreciating the chance you got, cause black is in your blood and you ain't even got the heart to stop. Black is stepping in for your brothers because your father's gone. Standing by your children when you haven't proven karma wrong. Black is doing all of the above, then going corner shop, trying to help a lady cross the road to have her walking off. Black is growing up around your family and making it, being forced to leave the place you love because there's hate in it. People say you're faking it, never stay for changing it, but black is being jealous. You'd be dead if you had stayed in it. Black is struggling to find your history and tracing it. You don't know the truth about your race because they're erasing it. Black has got a really sour flavor, here's a taste of it. But black is all I know, there ain't a thing that I would change in it. Look, black isn't a single colour, man, there's shades to it. Her hair's straight and thick, but mine's got waves in it. Black is not divisive, they've been lying and I'm hating it. Black has never been a competition, we're all making it. Black is deadly. Black is when you're freezing in your home and you can't get sleep, but never feeling empty, cause you got 20 cousins in your country living stress-free, walking for their water daughter wrapped inside a bedsheet. Black is distant, it's representing countries that never even existed while your grandmother was living. Black is my Ghanaian brother, reading into scriptures, doing research on his lineage, finding out that he's Egyptian. Black is people naming your countries and what they trade most, Coast of Ivory, Gold Coast, and the Grain Coast. But most importantly, to show how deep all of this pain goes, West Africa, Benin, they call the Slave Coast. Black is so confusing, could the culture they're in love with it? Take our features when they want and have their fun with it. Never seem to help with all the things we know will come with it. Loud in our laughter, silent in our suffering. Black is being strong inside the face of defeat. Poverty made me a beast. I battled the law in the streets. We all struggle, but your struggle ain't a struggle like me. Well, how could it be when your people gave us the odds that we beat? I mean, bloody hell. What about our brothers that are stuck in jail that couldn't bust the bell? They held a burden, got to live with it. Black is being guilty until proven that you're innocent. Black is saying free all of my people stuck inside of prison cells. Think it's funny we ain't got nothing to say to them. Unconditional love is strange to them, it's amazing. Black has really got the sweetest flavor, here's a taste of it. But black is all I know, there ain't a thing that I would change in it.